Continuing this section called The Marvel of Instruction, and this is describing various different modes of teaching. Longpo praised disciples who treated their problems as challenges to be overcome. He wanted monks to learn how to develop their own skillful means to deal with difficulties, rather than allowing themselves to be overly dependent on him. Most doubts about meditation practice were resolved through becoming aware of the nature of doubt itself, seeing it as a conditioned phenomenon and not identifying with it. This was one reason why he was not in favor of the daily interviews popular in meditation centers. They took too much responsibility away from the meditator and deprived them of opportunities to grow in wisdom. The Thai term for such interviews between meditation teacher and student is sop arom, literally mood inspection. Lumpur once joked, "Even dogs know their own moods. When they feel hungry, they howl." So, his advice was to keep putting as much effort as possible into formal meditation. In the body of practices that make up a monastic training, sitting and walking meditation constitute the backbone. Those whose practice is going to be strong are the ones who don't neglect their walking meditation, who don't neglect their sitting meditation, who don't let slip their sense restraint. Each monk had a walking meditation path some 20 to 30 paces long by the side of his kuti. As soon as the daily meal and cleanup was completed, the monks were encouraged to return immediately to their huts, put their robes out on a line to air, and begin to practice walking meditation. For those who did that regularly, this is Lumpur speaking, their walking path is worn into a furrow. I've seen it myself many times. Monks like that don't feel jaded or stale in their meditation. They have energy. They have real power. If you all give that kind of attention to your practice, it will go well. The training that Lumpur provided his monks was a well-rounded one. Monks learned how to meditate and were encouraged to meditate a lot. But they also learned the Vinaya in great detail. They also learned how to give the precepts to the lay people, how to chant blessings, and how to conduct funeral rites. They learned how to build and to take care of the monastery, and how to teach. When the time was ripe to begin their own monastic community, they had been furnished with all the basic tools that they would need to survive and flourish. So before going on a bit, the first part about doubt, and as he says here, most doubts about meditation practice were resolved through becoming aware of the nature of doubt itself, seeing it as a conditioned phenomenon and not identifying with it. That one sentence contains a lot, and since the ability of the mind to come up with questions and to get lost in its own its own sort of sense of incompleteness, wanting to know what the truth is, wanting to know what the right way forward is. What should I do? Tell me what to do. What's the right thing? What should I be doing? That is extraordinarily common for us as human beings, and we like to go to an authority figure to tell us what to do. That's very ordinary, very, very normal. And Lumpur did spend a huge amount of his time, a vast amount of his life, answering people's questions and responding, but as I was saying the other day, mostly what he would he was adept at doing was receiving people's questions, casually sort of dismantling them, and then handing the pieces back to the questioner, and having the questioner answer their own question. So it was quite an amazing thing to see him do that, and he would help people lead themselves to the conclusion of their own. Their own doubt. They would be able to, in a sense, discover that they understood the picture better than they realized. The dynamic of a doubt, just to speak about that in the way that Lumpur Sumedho would often teach about how to deal with that, is that we feel that with a doubt there's a question and it lacks an answer. And if we have got that answer, then we'll be complete. So we're like at that moment the universe feels like it's got something missing. If I just understood this, if I just had the answer, then the missing piece would be there and I would be happy. So that's the dynamic that gets set up is that if I just had this bit that's missing, then I would know what to do. I would have the answer, and things would be whole again. And so that both Lumpur Cha and Lumpur Sumedho were very very accomplished doubters. So they both had to work with this a lot. And I found the way that Lumpur Sumedho talked about it and helped to walk us through learning to deal with doubt was extremely helpful. And the way he would talk about it is to say that a doubt is telling you that something is missing. It's saying that there's you need an answer in order to be complete. But a doubt in itself is a complete thing. When the question arises, what should I do? That in itself is a condition that arises, does its thing, and passes away. It isn't incomplete. It's just a statement that the thinking mind is making, and it's saying that the universe is incomplete in that moment, but it's really in itself, it is just another sankhara. What should I do? It begins, it takes its shape, and it comes to an end. So what Lumpur Sumedho would encourage would be that sense of stepping out of the content of the question, of the doubt, and looking at the process in itself. And so a simple way of working with that, rather than buying into the question and saying, but I've got to know, I need to know, I have to have the answer. What really happened, or what should I do, and what is the best thing for me? To step out of it, to, in a sense, let go of the content of the question, and to just say, good question. That, yeah, that's a question. That we don't have to be intimidated or buy into it. It's because the universe is not complete just because this one particular human being hasn't got an idea or a plan in their mind or a piece of information. Because of the way the mind relates to things, it says, I need to know, I've got to know, I want to know, please give me the answer. But that is it's a deceptive picture, and that ability to recognize this is a question. It begins, it says its piece, and then it comes to an end. It's whole and complete. It's a sankhara that arises and passes away, just like everything else. So is a way of looking at thought, and particularly of questions that doesn't usually occur to us. We assume that if we have a doubt or a question, that it's valid and that we do need to know. We have to have an answer. We want to get the information. We should be able to figure it out and get a proper answer, and then things will be good. So it takes a certain amount of restraint to not buy into the question and say, well, yeah, that's a question. It arises, it passes away. Then the way that Lumpur Sumedho would encourage to work with that is to start off by learning how to watch a thought, not a question, but just making a conceptual statement, just to get perspective on the thinking mind, because we tend to believe in thoughts and take them so personally. So he would, I remember years ago being here at Amravati, and he would walk us through this, and he'd say, take a simple statement like, today is Sunday. It's non-personal, it's not emotionally loaded, it's just an ordinary statement. Today is Sunday. And to calm the mind as much as possible, and then just think that, notice the space before the statement is made, the mind being quiet, and then today is Sunday, watching the space afterwards. And so while that is there, because it's not personal, it's not emotionally loaded, it's not challenging or exciting or particularly interesting, then the ability to just see a thought taking shape and let it be known in the mind gets developed. You begin to develop that kind of skill. And then once you can do that with ordinary, bland, non-emotionally loaded, non-personal statements, then it becomes easier to do that with a question like, what should I do? What's the best practice for me? And to, again, seeing the space before, then what's the best practice for me? Then space after, and then it's just good question. There's a question there. The mind might say, well, that's all very well, Arjun, but I still need an answer. I want a direction. I want to know, what should I do? Or you tell me how it really is. But what happens is that if we are able to let the question, in a sense, leave the question alone, just let it take shape in the space of the mind, then our own intuitive wisdom is more able to operate in relationship to that. And so that then it's in a strange way that when you just let go of the question and don't buy into it, then the answers or ways of resolving the issues or seeing it in a different way can come much more easily arise. If you drop the question, the answer appears, or a different way of seeing it, like the insight can arise, wrong question, or there's no answer to that, or well, what are you interested to do? Then just do that and see what happens. So that there's a flexibility, there's a spaciousness, and the mind isn't so locked into the content of a particular doubt, but rather can see the whole thing in perspective. And as I was saying, the quality of intuitive wisdom is much more able to operate on that, to operate on that area. And you can, in a way, it's often the case that our heart understands the way that things are working. The citta, our intuitive wisdom, understands how things are working and how they're arranged far better than the thinking process at the surface level of our mind is able to articulate. So that's a little piece on doubt and working with doubt. Then this latter section where it talks about the kind of training that Lumpur would give to the Sangha, so that we learned not just to meditate, but also and learning the Vinaya in detail, how to give the precepts, how to chant, doing paritta chanting, blessing chants, how to do funerals. It was not uncommon in the forest monasteries for the monastic community not to be doing any of those kind of ceremonies. They wouldn't do funerals, wouldn't do house blessings and such like. So this is one of the things that Lumpur Cha tended to get criticized for, that in other forest monasteries, that would be considered, the village monks can do that. They can do house blessings, they can do wedding blessings, they can do funerals, they can take care of all of that kind of stuff. That's not, you should just get back to your kuti and practice. But Lumpur Cha actively encouraged and sort of pushed Sangha members to learn how to perform those ceremonies, and would accept invitations to go and do house blessings or perform wedding blessings or funerals and such like. And and so he was criticized from time to time by other forest ajans and people who had a lot of respect for him. And they sort of wondered, well, why do you waste your time doing that? This is all just sort of worldly, it feeds people superstition, or it's just worldly ceremonies, and these are ordinary functions that the village monastics can take care of. But Lumpur Cha's point was that I heard quoted several times, was that he saw that for many people, when there was a funeral or a wedding or a house blessing or some kind of special occasion of that nature, that was the only time that people ever actually invited the Sangha to their homes, or the only time they ever came in contact with the Dhamma. And so that he saw it was a good opportunity to give people teachings, and that particularly with funerals and such like, that they were that people were more open and would have an opportunity to hear the teachings, and their lives could really be benefited. So he saw it very consciously as a skillful means to help spread the teaching, and also to encourage Dhamma practice amongst the villagers and the lay community, so that there wasn't such a big gulf between the monastic community and the villagers, but also that he saw that given that opportunity, then a lot of people's lives could really be benefited, and then there was a knock-on effect, so that if the parents were well, influenced in a good way, if they were well impacted by the Dhamma teaching, then that would go to their children or to their other family members, and would trickle through the village in useful ways. And so that he was prepared to receive people's criticism, and to be sort of blamed, like, oh, you're just making your Sangha members waste their time doing all this stuff. But he was unbothered by that. He really saw there was a benefit. So that's why we do Purita chanting, and when we learn the funeral chanting and so forth, and so that we, following along in that same spirit, we also are ready to conduct those kind of ceremonies. So personally, I do house blessings. I don't do cars or boats or pets. I do happy to do house blessings, funerals. Baby blessings are very, very, very frequent. And also the sprinkling people with water, tying strings on. In some monasteries, that's completely verboten. You know, only in sort of low-grade monasteries, they do the water sprinkling and the tying strings on. That's kind of just superstition. But as people will have noticed, there's a lot of sprinkling and string tying that goes on here. But I take it in the same spirit that Lumpur Cha say put it forth, that it creates an opportunity. People come, and it's kind of interesting the number of people who they ask for a string to be tied on themselves, or they ask to be sprinkled, and they say, "Why do we do this?" Really, I wouldn't say more often than not, but it's extremely common. People from these from Sri Lanka or from Thailand, and they say, "Oh, please, can I have a string?" And then they say, "What's this for?" And today, just some families came and said, "Can you explain why we do this?" So, what I say is that it's a reminder. It doesn't guarantee that you'll pass that exam or that you'll get an upgrade in your job, or you'll live happily ever after. But what it does is it's a reminder of the visit to the monastery. And when you see the piece of string around your wrist, then helps you to recollect this place and the values of. So what I said today was, when your mind is inclined towards stressfulness, it reminds you that you can be free of stress. When things are getting complicated and agitated, then it reminds you that the mind can be free of complication and agitation. When people say, "Well, which hand should you tie it on?" Which one? I usually I will say, "The one that gets you into most trouble." then people they can understand that. So the one that's reaching for the cookie jar. So that is almost universally understood, that that's the point of it. And so I in the same spirit, I'm very consciously not trying to feed people's superstitions, as Ian Lumpur Cha was very much against that. But rather just cultivation of skillful means in this way, and that and he himself said, when George Sharp will often quote how, when he was visiting Lumpur Cha, and Lumpur Cha was sprinkling some water, and he said that he made the comment, "This has got nothing whatsoever to do with Buddhism, but people like it." It makes people happy. So I take it in that spirit. Lumpur would sometimes speak about the qualities of a good teacher. He must understand the ways his disciples' minds work, just as a carpenter must understand the particular qualities of each kind of wood. Or he must be like doctors who know their patients, the cause of their illness, and the appropriate medicine to cure their condition. Or he would say, it's like fishing. If the fisherman casts his net at random over the whole of the river, he won't get any fish. But he must wait until a fish breaks the surface of the water, then cast his net at exactly that spot. To teach, you have to look to see how much the student can take, he said. Look at what's just right for them, because it's the just rightness that is the Dhamma. Lumpur's ability to pitch his teachings on the just right level was so unerring that it convinced many monks, after private conversation with him, that he had been reading their minds. This may well have been true, but in most cases, the effectiveness of his words may be as easily attributed to acute observation based on long experience. Ajahn Suryon gave an example. So Ajahn Suryon was one of Lumpur Cha's early disciples. The Western disciples liked to see Lumpur laugh and smile and give them opportunities to ask questions. If he didn't do that and seemed indifferent towards them, they'd find it oppressive. So Lumpur would give them lots of attention, frequently asking them how they are, how their practice was going, and so on. The Thai monks didn't expect the same kind of personal attention. Again, Ajahn Suryon continues, If he saw that Thai monks understood his teaching well enough, he didn't say much to them, but he'd find appropriate skillful means to teach monks who were dull or unintelligent. With monks of an angry or negative disposition, he would speak humorously or give examples that emphasized kindness and gratitude. Once they felt relaxed, the minds of these monks would become receptive to what he was teaching and experience some joy and uplift in the Dhamma. As a result, they would feel inspired and their practice would progress. Ajahn Anaik recalled another of the similes Lumpur used to describe the qualities of a teacher. He said, "How could I be a teacher if I didn't understand the way my disciples' minds work? It's like the owner of a banana plantation. If he doesn't know all about bananas, their trunks, their leaves, their fruit, then how could he run a plantation? It's all just a matter of body and mind. It doesn't matter whether it's young monks, old monks, monastics or lay people. If their minds have fallen under the power of defilement, then there's no difference between them." Given Lumpur's profound understanding of the relationship between body and mind, it was not difficult for him to recognize his disciples' dispositions. He would observe them, walking, standing, sitting, lying down, changing posture, eating, bowing, working. He would notice their alertness and attention to detail when performing duties for him. Every action told him a story. The Buddha once said that just as integrity is to be known through long acquaintance and fortitude through adversity, wisdom is to be measured by speech. Lumpur observed how monks conducted themselves and how they expressed themselves. Meanwhile, Ajahn Liam observed Lumpur. This is Lumpur Liam speaking. Mostly he would gauge monks' knowledge from how they spoke. He would observe their reflections on Dhamma and the wisdom that was revealed in their speech. At the end of the rains retreat, he would have all the monks and novices take turns to ascend the Dhamma seat and talk about their experiences during the retreat to the lay people. This was one method he used to see how people's practice was going. Did they possess the qualities of a Dhamma speaker? You weren't to have any desire to give a talk, because then Lumpur considered that you were just following craving. He wanted to see who had a sense of responsibility. He wanted us to train in that way to see if we had any particular abilities. If we hadn't had to do that, we would never have known. So that I mentioned that before, that Lumpur, people often assume he was psychic because he was so good at reading people's situations and giving appropriate teachings. But as Ajahn Jayasaro puts it here, the effectiveness of his words may be as easily attributed to acute observation based on long experience. So he was, he said he wasn't psychic, but he would just he would watch people. He would see how people, how they walked, how they, as he said, how they ate, how they sat, how they related to work periods, how they related to washing their alms bowls or tidying the monastery up. And so just by being observant, he would see the particular characters that that people had, whether they were always just charging along and sort of and striding forcefully forward, or if they were just sauntering along, or if they were super careful about things, or they were very casual about things, whether they were always the first to volunteer for any kind of job, but then always the first to go and take a break before the work was finished. Or were they just wanting to be out in front and be seen to be the one doing all the work, or were they sort of just carrying on with what was needed and sort of keeping quietly and steadily at the job? He would observe, see if people were helping others out, or if they were just focused on what they were doing themselves. And so just by watching and looking and just say getting a sense of where people were at, then as he spoke and was in relation to people, he would let that, say, that sense of his observing, his sort of taking in where somebody was at, that would inform the way that he spoke and the kind of jobs he asked people to do or the roles that he asked them to perform. So it wasn't like keeping a sort of a data bank, you know, like scoring people and having a kind of a whole sort of plot to... that some Western monks thought he was doing. Waropano actually asked him one day, you know, are you setting this all up on purpose? You know, when he thought Lumpur Cha was kind of creating situations specifically to teach him lessons. And that he was sort of rigging a whole thing, plotting with other monks to kind of make sure that Waraponu had some really difficult challenge that was exactly what he didn't want. And Lumpur thought it was hilarious that, you know, this Farang monk, this Westerner, would actually say that to him, you know, confront him and say, "Are you setting this up? You're doing this on purpose? You're plotting with Ajahn Sinowan, aren't you?" You know, and it's just not a way that any Thai monk would ever speak to the Ajahn. But Waraponu was a New Yorker as well as being a Westerner, so very forthright. And Lumpur thought that was hilarious. He says, "No, it's just you know, I just thought we needed someone for that to go to Ban Su and Glory, and I saw you, and I thought, oh, Waraponu, that's a good fit." You know, exactly. And he said, "But you knew I didn't want to go there. I told you, the last place I want to go is Suan Gloy." Lumpur said, "Yeah, I might have remembered that, but, you know, the van's going in 10 minutes. Get ready." You know. So it was very, as I said before, it was very much a situational teaching, so that the certain amount was the Dhamma talks, but a lot was just the situations of living. And that Lumpur would be and simply be observant and let that quality of observation be what guided the way that he related to people. So whether he praised someone or criticized someone or just ignored someone or brought someone forward or held someone back, it would all just, he wouldn't plot anything or plan it. He would just be working very, very intuitively moment by moment. And you could never second guess him. You could never predict how he was going to handle any individual situation. So, any particular thoughts, questions, reflections on all of that? Yes?
I remember, I think I was 2 weeks into being an agarika in white, and I got an opportunity to be with Lumpur quite alone. And I asked him about doubt. I said, "What about doubt?" And he said, "Well, what about it?" But he put his hands up. Sort of thing, you know, what about it?
Mm-hmm.
Then I was called out of the room and I went into the kitchen and I remember the gesture I wanted, and he said, "What about it?" And I said, "Yeah, what about it?" And I walked away. As I walked away, and that stayed with me a lot, you know, that it's just another thing that arises and ceases, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a strong teaching for me, actually. It really, it was very fast. I mean, in between me asking and being pulled out of the room,
mm-hmm.
having no time to breathe almost. So, but when I got into my room, I thought, "Oh, yeah, I asked that question." And he said, "What about it?" And I said, "What about it?" At the same time. So it was very reminiscent, a strong memory of that asking.
Yeah, and when there's a doubt sort of arising in the mind, it can seem like something that's really overpowering or has to be resolved. But it's what Lumpur Samhita would often point out is that, said, you know, you say I've got this doubt, I've got this problem. He said, but you think it's there all the time, but it's not. It comes and goes. So he would say, notice that it's not there all the time. Similarly with other issues or difficulties. He said, you know, you might say you're an angry person, or you're always jealous, or you're always you're always lustful. He said, no, you're not. So but if you look, yeah, there's a doubt. The doubt arises, but sometimes you forget that there's that problem. You forget the doubt is there, and when he would bring that up and talk about it in that way, you could tell people going, yeah, that's right. There was one. A fellow who was a monk in this community for a few years, when he was a student, he was from Holland, and his father was a scientist, and he was doing a degree in mathematics. He had a very sort of rational mind as a young person, but he got obsessed by the question of whether God exists or not, and he said he just couldn't put that down. It was just really burdening him, stressing him. And so he had been at the university, away, he left home and gone to university, and he'd been at university for a couple of terms, and he was really burning with this issue and burdened by this, does God exist, does he not, and trying to logically work out, you know, through whether God exists or not. And then he said what happened was that he got up one morning and he was standing in the bathroom brushing his teeth and looking at his face in the mirror and said, "Oh, I've been awake for 10 minutes and I haven't worried about whether God exists or not." And then it hit him, like, if I don't think about it, it's not a problem. So, you know, sort of standing there with his toothbrush in his hand, like, oh, and that really did. It was one of those things that, you know, a great insight dawns not in the meditation hall, but, you know, sometimes just in the middle of brushing your teeth, and that really changed everything for him. If I don't think about it, it's not a problem. Oh, it really isn't a problem. Not just it is a problem. I'm simply not paying attention to it. Like there's a debt, but I've forgotten I've got a debt, but the debt is still there. It hit him that no, if I don't think about it, if I don't create it, it isn't a problem. And it hit him in a way that had never really struck him before. And so I said, so what happened then? He said, so then I came to become an anagarika. Which is pretty much what he did. Okay, so to continue. Longpo would say that once you can ground your mind in the present moment, everything is ready to teach you. Insights into the three characteristics arise naturally in the mind. Often, he would share his own reflections with those around him. His disciples would treasure these teachings and observations not so much because they were especially profound, although sometimes they were, but rather it was because they were grounded in a particular event in which the listener participated, and so took on an immediacy, an intimacy, and context that was not easily forgotten. Ajahn Pasno, for example, recounted how one morning, while returning from alms round, a pair of lizards copulating in a roadside tree fell off their branch and landed right in front of Longpo. Still stuck together, they lay on the ground, looking stunned from the fall. Longpo pointed at them, chuckling, "You see that? They were enjoying themselves so much up there they became heedless. Now they've fallen down and hit the ground. It hurts." Longpo created an environment in which every element of monastic life provided challenges and learning opportunities for his disciples. His formal discourses provided his disciples with the reflective tools to profit from them. Sometimes there could be an almost sly quality to Lumpur's skillful means. He introduced small tests of mindfulness and wisdom for his disciples that were like concealed traps of a hunter in the forest. One monk remembered an almost comical example. In the midst of a relaxed and informal meeting under Lumpur's kuti, a number of conversations taking place at the same time, Lumpur must have sensed that things were becoming a little too exuberant and monks were losing their mindfulness in the pleasure of conversation. Without warning, he stopped speaking and began to sit in silence with eyes downcast. Monastic etiquette deems it impolite to carry on a conversation in front of one's teacher. The disciple takes his cue from the master. If the teacher speaks informally, so can he. If the teacher stops speaking, then so does the disciple, immediately. But it's hard not to get caught up in a conversation, and easy to lose awareness of a situation. The monks carried on talking for a while, one by one, look by look, and then by a sudden avalanche of urgent nudges, they stopped and tried to compose themselves. As if in a theatrical skit, there remained a single monk relating some humorous anecdote, and then, in one awful moment, realizing that the atmosphere had completely changed. Everyone around him was sitting impassively, with eyes downcast. There was no need for Lumpur to utter any words of admonition. In a similar vein, a monk recalled how, while walking to a local village on alms round, Lumpur engaged him in conversation. In such a situation, etiquette demanded that he walk slightly behind Lumpur and to one side, with the remaining monks expected to walk some few steps behind. All of a sudden, Lumpur stopped still. The monks whose minds had wandered collided with the monk in front of them, and the line came to a shuddering halt. Lumpur, looking very innocent, said nothing. At the next Dhamma talk, he spoke about the importance of mindfulness and alertness in every posture, for example, on alms round. Sense restraint, circumspection, mindfulness and alertness, sensitivity to time and place, these were basic monastic virtues that Lumpur never tired of impressing on the minds of his disciples. He would say that, quote, "someone who loses their mindfulness is no different from a madman," unquote. And he would quote the Buddha's words, "heedfulness is the path to the deathless, heedlessness the path to death." That's kind of the Amaravati's motto that Lumpur Samhita will also quote over and over again. mindfulness is a path to the deathless. That's Dhammapada, verse 21. Also, speaking about the Lumpur's capacity to teach according to the appropriate situation, or to, as he said, if the monks were dull or unintelligent, he would find ways to get through to them and to help brighten things up. Or if somebody was angry or negative, he'd speak humorously and incline the mind towards kindness and gratitude. There was an incident that in the introduction to Lumpur Cha's collected teachings, where that I recounted, I asked me to write the introduction to the book. So I told this story of how there was this one young Western monk who'd been away living at one of the branch monasteries, and he'd come into this state of really deep depression, incredible sadness, and just the sorrows of the world were written large all around him, and he was just overburdened and stressed by this kind of darkness of samsara and the painfulness of the living world. So he'd come back to, he was living at Lumpur Jan's monastery, Bunka Luang. And so Lumpur Jan said, well, I better go and see Lumpur. You know, you can't get any perspective on this state. You know, go and see Lumpur and see what he says to you. So this young bhikkhu went to Lumpur and said, oh, Lumpur, I can never smile again. I can never laugh again. The world is just so full of misery and pain. It's just, it's utterly despairing to look around and to see how life is. You know, I just feel so sad, so much pain in the world. And then within 45 minutes, he was actually rolling on the floor, literally weeping with laughter, clutching his sides, unable to, and, you know, rolling on the floor in front of the teacher is something that you don't do. But he was laughing so much, Lumpur had to sort of led him into this story, and was telling him, giving him this account of this squirrel that was trying to learn how to climb trees and jump from one branch to another. And Lumpur was sort of enacting the learning process of this squirrel, getting it at kindergarten and then junior school and then senior school and then university, and then it was getting a master's degree and then a PhD in tree climbing and branch jumping. And he had sort of drawn him in and sort of encouraged him so much. He was literally just weeping with laughter. And 45 minutes before, he was never going to smile again. You know, he couldn't see any kind of happiness in the world, but that he was literally out of control, convulsing with laughter within a short period of time. So Lumpur had an amazing knack of sort of reaching into people's mind states and helping them to sort of get a perspective on it that was very magical, wonderful. So the next section is called Worldly Winds. A monastery does not provide an escape from the vicissitudes of life. So vicissitudes is problems, difficulties, ups and downs, troubles. A monastery does not provide an escape from the vicissitudes of life. It does provide a framework in which a wise attitude towards them may be cultivated. The Buddha referred to four pairs of transient conditions inherent in the human realm that needed to be clearly understood. Again, this is Lumpur Cha speaking. The Buddha taught that the eight worldly dhammas of gain and loss, status and obscurity, praise and blame, pleasure and pain are inescapable features of human life. Even liberated beings experience these conditions, but knowing them for what they are, impermanent, unreliable events, they remain unfazed by them, so that the liberated beings are unfazed or untroubled, unburdened, unstressed by those eight worldly dhammas, the loka dhammas. Lumpur frequently reminded his disciples to maintain a contemplation of the nature of the eight worldly dhammas and not to get pulled about by them. He said that only fools believed that they could enjoy the desirable worldly dhammas without encountering their undesirable counterparts. They were inseparable. So gain and loss go together. Status and obscurity go together. Praise and blame go together. Pleasure and pain. You can't just have gain, status, praise, and pleasure. You can try, But it doesn't really work that way. If you're holding onto the wheel as it goes up, you're still holding onto the wheel as it goes down. If you want to, as the wheel spins, you try and let go of the wheel as it reaches the top. Good luck. But it doesn't work that way. And so the worldly dhammas, they create their opposites. So that there's always a mixture of those four different polarities. His teachings on the eight conditions were often very practical. They commonly consisted of confronting monks with the consequences of attachment by depriving them of one of their four desirable worldly dhammas, or provoking one of the undesirable ones. Lumpur might, for example, test a monk by praising him on a number of occasions and then, with no forewarning, roundly criticize him. The monk was encouraged to observe that the degree to which he was upset by the criticism was an indication of the degree to which he had identified with and taken pride in the praise. On other occasions, Lumpur might give a monk a great deal of attention for a certain period of time and then completely ignore him for a while. The monk would be left feeling hurt and forced to acknowledge that the pain he experienced was chiefly determined by the extent to which he had allowed himself to feel flattered with the attention and had indulged in a sense of being special or entitled. So that happened fairly regularly, testing. And one incident that Ajahn Viradhamo talks about very frequently was when he first did the recitation of the Patimokkha. So this is that every fortnight we have the formal recitation of our rules. So it takes about 40, 45 minutes, about 13,000 words. So a few of the venerables here are accomplished reciters. On the sister's side you have 150 rules that you recite. So it's quite a task to memorize that all and to recite it solo in the presence of the whole community. And so when Ajahn Viradhamo first did that as a junior monk, then at Wat Bapong, when he was, this would be about 40, 45 years ago, then Lumpur Cha said, "Oh, well done." And he always called him Lung Ta Vi. Lung Ta is sort of literally means like venerable uncle, or it's usually a form of address for older men when they've gone into the monastic life in their middle age. Even though Ajahn V was only like in his early 20s, Lumpur always thought he looked like a Lung Ta, and so he always called him Lung Ta V. It was what he was known as ever since he was like 23 years old. Lung Ta V. Who knows why? Lung Ta Vi, Swat Geng Mak, you did a really good job chanting, well done. And so he was really glowing at the end of that, praise in front of the Sangha by Lumpur, very, very happy. And so then, when it's time on the fortnightly recitation, then somebody might volunteer, or it might be one of the senior monks will say, who's available to chant the Patimokkha? Is anyone ready and got the recitation prepared? And so usually there's people say, I can do it next, or if there's nobody else wants to do it, I can. So there's a kind of polite hesitancy. But Ajahn V, having been praised by Lumpur Cha, thought, I'll do it. Yeah. Kind of eager to volunteer himself. So you can tell what's coming. So he really set himself up for it. So, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think it was unusual for the same person to do it two sessions in a row. And so Ajahn V got up to do the recitation the next time. And so then, and usually the rest of the Sangha are sitting silently, you're just listening with your hands in Anjali as the one person is doing the recitation, and you have another one who's keeping track of the recitation in the book, and if you make any mistakes, then the other person corrects you, because you have to have a word perfect recitation of the whole thing, so that if you make a single mistake, then you're stopped and you have to say the word again. So usually everyone else is sitting there silently, but as Ajahn V began his recitation, then Lumpur Cha started chatting with some of the other senior monks, just sort of making conversation quite noticeably. Just kind of chit-chatting, and then starts tugging on Ajahn V's robe and saying, "Oh, these Farangs, don't they ever wash their robes? He really stinks, this one." and making all these very rude personal remarks about Ajahn Vee's bathing habits or lack of cleanliness. And so Ajahn Vee's hearing all this, and he's trying to keep focused on the recitation, but of course it's extremely challenging. And so then he's getting flustered and losing his place and having to be corrected. And Lumpo Charles carries on completely. Oh, he can't even chant. He was good last time. He's pretty useless now. Yeah. Well, maybe it was just a flash in the pan. He got it right one time, but I guess he's pretty useless. These Farangs are pretty stupid, really, aren't they? And so that was a learning experience. Ajahn Vee, 45 years later, still has that writ carved deeply into his memory banks. But it was a good teaching because the degree, the degree to which he was inflated and flattered by Lumpo praising him in front of everyone, then Lumpo was sort of testing to see, okay, is he ready to be, have his balloon punctured and to be deflated in front of everyone? Any questions on that? Of course, I would never do such a thing on purpose.
It seemed a little bit cruel.
Well, it's the judgment of the teacher, and also then he would also be observant as to see how somebody took that, whether if he did something like that, then if he saw somebody really was very kind of upset and distraught and really fell to pieces, then he thought, okay, that was too much. Yeah, okay. And then he would take steps to be very comforting and encouraging and so forth. So he was, again, he was extremely observant. So he would test things out and then see what the response was and then what was going to be effective. So that another incident with Ajahn Viradhamma was during the Katina season. Often you go from one monastery to another, have these festivals, and often the Dhamma talks would go all night long. And so the young Ajahn Vee had been on one of these sort of Katina festival tours, and he'd been up several nights in a row and was really exhausted, and he kind of keeled over and had a seizure. And Lumpur was incredibly comforting to him and said, you're trying too hard, you're doing too much, calm down, just go back to your kuti, take a rest. I don't want to see you till tomorrow morning. Just you ignore the rest of the festivities, just go back to your kuti, lie down, have a good sleep, you're doing too much. So he was extremely gifted at reading situations, but he wasn't afraid of testing people. So that there could be some very challenging physical tests. I was telling the story the other day about how one monk who was very proud of his samadhi, then Lumpur took him on this extended trip, and they wouldn't let him sleep for 6 nights in a row, 6 days and 6 nights, that they kept him awake. And he himself was awake for six days and 6 nights. That was a pretty extreme teaching, but it did give that monk a lesson, like, oh yeah, I'm definitely attached to my samadhi, attached to looking good in front of other people, and the teacher is roundly criticizing me for falling asleep in public. And so that the monk himself who told that story. So he was happy to say, I was really inflated and proud of my own abilities, but Lumpur very compassionately popped my bubble. So this next section is called Transmitting the Theory. Lukewarm, quote-unquote, would probably best sum up the attitude of the forest monasteries of the Isan to the academic study of Buddha Dhamma. With their focus on the practice and realization of the truth of the teachings, the abbots of these monasteries have considered in-depth study of them to be a two-edged sword. While they recognize that a knowledge of key teachings provides the necessary theoretical basis for practice, they've been suspicious of the seductive nature of study. Gaining more and more intellectual knowledge about the path can easily come to seem more important than actually walking it. Over the years, Lumpur gave many analogies for such an error. He said it was like a person who pores over a map but does not make the journey, or one who reads the label on the medicine bottle but doesn't take the medicine. Lungpo and his contemporaries expressed concern at how book learning tended to stimulate the speculative, restless traits of their disciples' minds that other aspects of the training were designed to restrain. Most importantly, perhaps, they were concerned by the way in which concepts absorbed from the texts created expectations in the minds of their disciples that hindered rather than helped their meditation. One of Lungpo's most well-known injunctions to newcomers was, "Don't read the books, read your mind." And this is Lungpo speaking here. "You may know how to write the word greed, but when greed arises in your mind, it doesn't look like the word. Anger is the same. You may have it down on the blackboard as an arrangement of letters, but when anger arises in your mind, you don't have time to read anything. It's already too late. This is very important, extremely important. Your knowledge is correct. You've spelt the word correctly, but now you have to bring it inwards. If you don't do that, then you won't know the truth." On reaching a state of meditative calm, he said, the tendency of the scholar is to instinctively reach for his knowledge of the texts, to interpret what he's experiencing. That movement of the mind to name or classify the experience causes the experience to dissolve. And this is Lungpo speaking here. If a student of the texts grasps on tightly to his knowledge and upon entering peaceful states likes to keep noting, what's this? Is this the first absorption yet? Then his mind will simply make a complete retreat from the calm and he'll get nothing from it. Why is that? Because he wants something. The moment there's craving to realize something, the mind withdraws from the calm. That's why you've got to throw away all your thoughts and doubts and to take only your body, speech and mind into the practice. Look inwardly at states of mind, but don't drag your scriptures in there with you. It's not the place for them. If you insist on doing so, then everything will go down the drain, because nothing in the books is the same as it is in experience. It's precisely because of this attachment that people who study a lot, who have a lot of knowledge, tend to be unsuccessful in meditation. It was not that forest monks rejected study altogether. They were exceptionally thorough in their studies of the Vinaya, particularly of the Pupasikara commentary. Indeed, the importance they gave this text is one of the defining characteristics of the whole tradition. Many monks had, moreover, also completed the Thai Sangha's national three-tier Dhamma Vinaya curriculum, Naktam, before they became disciples of Lungpu Man. Lungpo himself falls into this category. And so, they began their practice in the forest with a solid theoretical foundation. Nevertheless, the forest sangha's apparently dismissive attitude to study tended to raise the hackles of scholar monks, many of whom saw the forest monks as ignorant mavericks, following their own opinions rather than the words of the Buddha. In fact, a low-level mistrust between meditators and scholars has been a feature of sangha life since the time of the Buddha. In one sutta, Venerable Mahachunda sensibly encourages the forest monks and the scholars to appreciate each other's good qualities rather than criticize their shortcomings. That's in the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Sixes, Sutta number 46. In the case of Wat Pa Phong, the relationship with the scholarly community took a significant turn for the better in 1967, when a locally prominent scholar, Ajahn Maha Amorn, joined the Sangha and was enthusiastic in his praise of Lungpo. In one respect, Lungpo's emphasis on oral transmission of the teaching within the context of a teacher-student relationship was a return to the ways of early Buddhism. If there was a weakness to his impromptu style, it was that his Dhamma talks, being unsystematic by definition, did not cover the whole breadth of Buddha Dhamma and were difficult to remember. Their strength lay in his grounding the theory of Dhamma, Pariyatti, firmly within the lives of his disciples and their practice, Pattipatti, for liberation, Pativeta. He selected the teachings that he felt were of most benefit given the time, the place and the audience. But in the first year at Wat Pa Phong, with a small community of just 7 monks, Lungpo, ever the experimenter, was as yet undecided on the value of the Naktam curriculum. He decided to teach it himself, in order to determine the advantages and the disadvantages. It was the first time that he'd taken on such a role since his last frustrating rains retreat in Bangkor, that was his home village when he was a village monk, after which he had embarked upon the life of the Tudong monk. He taught the course over a period of 48 hour days. In the cold season, the monks took the exams and all passed. But it was as he had feared. The monks found it hard to integrate the sense restraint and single-mindedness required to develop the meditation practice with the memorization and discussion that are essential to study. They forgot themselves, he said simply. He found monks becoming neglectful of their meditation. The amount of socializing increased, together with its accompanying worldliness, mental agitation, and formation of cliques. Which is kind of interesting, in only 7 months, they still managed to have cliques, plural. Doesn't take much, I guess. Yeah. The serene atmosphere of the monastery was significantly diminished. He was, however, at pains to point out that the problem did not lie in study itself. This is Lumpur speaking. In fact, all the teachings point out the way for us to practice. But having begun to study, if you get caught up in chatting and frivolity and dispense with your walking meditation, then you'll start wanting to disrobe. Actually, he said, when performed mindfully, reading and memorizing are forms of meditation. It's not that study itself is at fault, but the lack of application and discernment on the part of the students. Following his unsatisfactory experiences in this first year, Lungpur suspended the teaching of Nak Tum. In later years, however, when the number of monks had increased and Lungpur became concerned by how little knowledge they had of the basic teachings, he relented, delegating one of his senior disciples to provide the instruction. But familiar problems started to appear in the Sangha, outweighing the gains. Eventually, Lungpur compromised by allowing monks interested in pursuing their studies to do so alone in their spare time. The monastery supplied the necessary textbooks and arranged for monks' official registration with the National Examination Board, but everything else was left to self-study. After the exams were over, Lungpur would tell the monks to put their books away and now concentrate on reading their minds. Study of the texts, pariyatti, was useful, he said, but should not become an end in itself. There was no true conclusion to such study. Without practicing the teachings, monks ran the risk of being like cowherds who'd never drunk milk. There was another kind of study, an internal pariyatti. And this is Lumpur speaking here. Are you just going to keep on studying endlessly without a fixed goal? Or do you have an end in mind? Study is good, but it's an external pariyatti. The internal pariyatti requires you to study these eyes, these ears, this nose, this tongue, this body, this mind. It's the true pariyatti. What happens when the eye contacts a form? The ears hear a sound. The nose smells an odor. The tongue tastes a flavor. The body contacts a tangible object, or a mental phenomenon arises in the mind. How does it feel? Is there still greed? Is there still aversion? Are you deluded by forms, sounds, odors, these ears, this nose, this tongue, this body, this mind? This is the internal pariyatti, and it has an end. You can graduate. So I will leave it there for today.